And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9 388-4643.
There we go. The Donnas up on the housetop, and another one of our favorites. The Christmas hits keep on coming, and you know what else keeps coming? Books from John Parada. John, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. You know, this is different, obviously, but. It certainly felt like it was in your wheelhouse. You mentioned this idea to me, I don't know, a couple of years ago that you were toying with it. And when you get a notion in your head, there's going to be a product at the end.
Listen, before we go on, I want to congratulate Jay Brittman on his
nice
being enrolled. I mean, he's as pops in the game as you can find, so good for Jay. We did talk about this book a few years ago, and that goes back to 2019, I think. I was at the Irish Derby at the Curra, and an Australian gentleman I started talking to. I was lucky enough to be in the Coolmore suite to watch the race, and this gentleman started talking to me, and funny enough, he started asking me about how to find out information about how to own horses. And I'm thinking, here you are, you're like in the, you know, the center of the horse universe to me. And I said, well, I'm playing with this idea of, you know, putting together something for people, not about gambling at all. It's if you want to talk about gambling, you go to Rich Eng's Horse Racing for Dummies. That's the primer for that. But so I started picking away at this, and I was ready to go several times, and then did one thing after another. I'd say, well, let me look a little further into this, look a little further into that. And it's not for the essential help and guidance that I got from Jay Hovde. I don't think this would have come about. But it's really intended. We got tired of seeing so many people come and go, owners that would come into the game and disappear because they'd either been fleeced or mishandled. I want to put it to, I guess that's putting it lightly, isn't it? Because people would read these trainer percentages, or they would, you know, read statistics and think that's all there is to it. And as you and I both know, there's a lot more to the game than raw statistics.
No doubt. How did you organize this, John? And because this is, you know, this is voluminous, and I'm also curious how you sense or how you discovered what's changed in the recent landscape when it comes to, you know, any of these areas that people can you know, can get involved, that can invest essentially in the game?
Well, it wasn't something that just occurred to me. You know, the concept occurred to me, but how to go about it took a while. I looked at, there were a number of, you know, similar type of books that have been done over the years, even including Todd Campbell's book. The thing that I thought was necessary was some updating, because all the assets are there. I mean, I really didn't invent the wheel here. There's a plethora of assets available to horse owners or prospective horse owners. The Jockey Club's owner view, the online, there's tons of things. The CBA's website, there's just tons of, but when a person says, well, where do I go look? They need a place to start. So I kind of decided to make this book in the form of a primer or a guidebook to get you to those places. You know, people say, well, how do I get my license? How do I, you know, oh, I don't want to get fingerprints. How do you name your horse? I really want to name my horse this, you know. All the little minutiae that falls afterwards when you deal with the broad concepts. So, I hope these good people in the right direction here, and I'm sure I'll get a million emails and calls. And you left this out, you didn't put this in, but I mean, we banged away at this for quite a long time, and. I'm sure I neglected to mention some people, and people will say that I over-emphasized some players, but I was trying to use examples and, trying to lay it out in one place for people to go.
There's a dozen chapters, and it is kind of a how, you know, essentially it tries to cover all the bases. One area, though, John, that is, I think, is worth exploring under the idea of a business plan. And if you had to advise somebody about approaching the ownership side, what's the great saying? Everybody has got a plan until they get punched in the face.
So, Mike Tyson, yes, thank you. So put that as a chapter.
Yeah. How much, I'm thinking about, Rich Migliori had us, had me do one of the ownership seminars that NYRA had organized. And after hearing about, this is how it works, and this is, the partnership, this is how you're going to get, this is what will, the summary, and you'll get paid every month. And I I recall saying to people, this is not a business. You might approach it with the mindset of a business, and the things that you apply in your day-to-day life, in your professional life, but that essentially it's a pastime. It's something that you're doing with disposable income. How do you respond to the, to the comparison or the juxtaposition between, trying to approach this from a prudent financial basis versus, understanding that every dollar you put in, there's a potential or even a likelihood you're not going to get it back?
Well, it just kind of comes down to, it's like I said to my wife before we got married. I said, this is going to be very successful as long as you have low expectations. and so far, so good. But it is a game, as one trainer, John Forbes, once said to me. He said, this is a game where people could give you the horses for free and you could still lose money. So keeping that in mind, I did address in one chapter, in the game plan chapter, that, you know, the guys that come along and say, wait a minute, they've made millions in some business, and they said, oh, well, and their line is always the same. Well, it's a business. You've got to run it like a business. Well, that's fine. You do have to run it like a business, but it's a horse business. It's not your business. You're not making whatever, tables and chairs or medical products or whatever. You're not doing that. It's a unique proposition to begin with. And, you know, I think that a lot of the syndicates do a very good job of laying that out to people, going in saying that if this is something that you want to pursue as a passion, you can't use the hobby because the hobby tax laws and everything, and that's very well explained by Len Green. But it does require some passion for the game. And if you have that, and you want to satisfy that, then you go from there. So you don't take a giant step, a leap in the beginning, and say, oh, yeah, I'm going to throw $1 million at this, or I'm going to throw $2 million or $5 million, whatever. You need to have it figured out. What's your intention? Do you want to breed? Do you want to race? Do you want to race and breed? Do you want to buy and sell? And then I go over, I can't say it enough, that you have to vet out your people. You have to vet out your advisors, especially. And when you get the right advisors, and there are plenty of them in the game. I cite the Blood Horse Source magazine as a great place to go. And, you know, a lot of times people are better off interviewing some people that live near them so they can have personal interaction face-to-face and get together with them and get comfortable. And then your game plan will evolve. I think I explained that the company that I was with for a long time, with Due Process, back in the 80s, it started out, we had 6 horses, and they had 12, and then we had 50, and we had 100, and all of a sudden we had 3, and I think, you know, we had hundreds of horses, and they just grew and grew and grew and multiplied. And if you don't have something clear in your head about where you're going with them, boy, they eat a lot, those horses, and they have to eat every day. It's undeniable. You know, we've seen recently some examples of people that have had huge organizations that they formed, had very successful stallions even, which is the big money source, you know, the big goal of a lot of people, to get a stallion because they throw off so much income. But we've seen people that come in and do that, and the next thing you know, their trainers are selling their horses at the courthouse steps to get paid. You don't want to do that. I don't think anybody really wants it. You know, so you have to have a very realistic game plan, and you have to have extremely trustworthy people advising you. So.
From that standpoint, John Parrotto with us, and John has published Thoroughbred Investor's Bible as a resource tome to help people enter the game armed with understanding and with the kind of background that will help you navigate what can be, you know, a perilous undertaking. And two-pronged question to that, John. In making those evaluations about, you know, somebody you're comfortable with and is trustworthy, I mean, how do you know? Because it's a game where even even people with track records, it doesn't guarantee that you know the next chapter or the next the next set of horses that are acquired are for a client are necessarily going to be as successful. It's such a, and I don't want to say what have you done for me lately, because that that's not entirely fair, but it is a sort of a quicksilver landscape there's so many parts of this that can go wrong, and it might be with the stock to begin with, or if the stock might be credible, it could happen on the training side the things go awry, or placement. I mean, there's so many places that a neophyte is confronted with potential difficulties and understanding what's happening as it's happening.
That's absolutely true, Steve. And early in the book, I do note some examples, California Chrome, Seattle Slough, even things like that, where people do catch lightning in a bottle. They do have that extraordinary success, and it happens. We hear about it because they're great things to write about, but let's keep in mind that it is a game where you can do everything absolutely right and still get a bad result just because of the, the luck of the draw. And that's why I tell people that the game plan is really important, and you don't evolve it immediately. You let it, it takes a little while for you to figure out actually. You need to watch, you need to study it a little bit before you jump in. And that's what I was trying to do, to guide people to all the different, if you start picking through the book and say, well, let me see, I'll look into this and I'll look into that, you could take a while studying it before you jump in. And that's what I would advise people to do. Otherwise, if you want to go with random, just jump in and throw your money at somebody, good luck to you.
I mentioned a two-prong follow-up. Is there, and I haven't seen the full book yet, but is there an individual or an approach that you anonymously cite that you'd suggest people emulate?
Well, there's some of the source material that you can find, like the Consigners and Commercial Breeders Association. It's called CBA. Mm-hmm. They have an excellent website. It was set up, a number of people set it up, but I credit Rob Whiteley, who managed the Foxfield operation for Carl Icahn for many years back when we were kind of contemporaries back in the 80s and 90s. And Rob's been an extremely successful commercial breeder of a ton of Group 1, Grade 1 horses. And, that's a very well set up. That's a good place to start. The Jockey Club, America's Best Racing, has a site called Overview, which deals with a lot of the detail that you need to be aware of. I said a number of websites, that'll lead you down the correct path, I think.
Well, and in fact, you mentioned Overview and Toba. They just wrapped up on Tuesday. Last Tuesday, you had the last of this year's new owner seminars that are
absolutely that's a great place for people to get started. As long as they go looking to learn, don't be looking to impress anybody. Go looking to learn, and I think a lot of people have been successful with those seminars.
Obviously the partnership landscape, John, and we visited semi-regularly, and the partnership concept, and actually the club concept, and of course the Dublin Racing Club idea that you created and had a handful of horses the last couple of years that we've talked about. The racetrack organizations have successfully introduced undoubtedly the Churchill Downs Club with Lucas was wildly successful, and you mentioned Len Green before, the Greens and Aaron Yagoda helped Empire Racing get going in New York with proven strategies, and they've had success. I mean, that concept, and I've crafted with Chuck Simon and with Gary Siaka was a $500, same thing, that $500 buy-in, no bills, and it's proven to be a really good avenue, a great pain-free introduction just for people to kind of come in and look around and have communication with an outfit and get a sense of a direction. How do you treat the landscape involving the partnerships and advice on that front of wading into ownership that way?
Well, I mean, you hit the nail on the head there, Steve. I mean, at the beginning of that chapter, I quote Arnold Kirkpatrick. He always used to say that it's better to own part of a good horse than to own all of a bad one, and which is the best way to get into the game, owning a piece of a horse and, learning in baby steps at first. And there's so many people, as we know, that have come into the game by owning a small piece, either through back in the Dogwood days with Pat Campbell, with West Point. I don't want to start picking out, I've done it, I didn't mean to mention too many individual names because there are a lot of them that different ones fit different people. But that's a good way to get started, own a little piece of a horse. You and I have both done partnerships and that sort of thing, syndicates of sort. I did one in Ireland, and COVID kind of derailed us, as it did a lot of people. But that's the best way to get started. Unless you have the unlimited assets of somebody who wants to create an empire immediately, then you make a different game plan, don't you?
I've got a funny, humorous, but some might find it humorous. I've got an interesting question. Who, John, and you've seen all kinds of people in decades of involvement in the game, and believe me, I'm not trying to, by this question, not trying to inhibit anybody from getting involved, but in your experience, what kind of person doesn't belong and will find this a frustrating, unsatisfying experience? Because frankly,
that's a great question,
right?
Because it is funny. It is a funny question because and the person you're talking about, it doesn't mean they're a bad person. It just means they're psychologically not suited.
Exactly.
It's a person who can't stand to lose at anything, because the first premise of horse racing is that you can't win every race. I don't care whether you're gambling. Every gambler knows that you can't win every race. You're going to lose sometime, either through bad luck or bad pick or whatever. And it goes the same with owning horses. You can't win every race, and people get frustrated. I've watched guys, and I have a number of examples of that has happened over the years where people, all of a sudden, you're 4-5 in a race, and look like you can't get beat, and they finish last. And they get mad. Well, you know, that person is not suited for the game. It's the person who can shrug it off. A great analogy is the professional golfer. If you have a triple bogey, if you or I have a triple bogey, we probably triple bogey the next hole. But if Cantlay or Koepka or one of those guys has a triple bogey, they come back and they birdie the next three holes. So you have to have that ability to accept that you can't be perfect. You cannot achieve perfection. And when you do have one of those runs where you have a horse is great and just decides it, just enjoy it and don't think you have anything to do with it. You were lucky. You know, you did everything right, and you were fortunate enough to be lucky. Nothing's guaranteed, but that's a great question.
And I would, as a corollary or an entry mate question to that, ask about partners and. Being involved with people, we're in an era, John, that has certainly changed. Where when you see people who could easily be doing this and continue to do it on their own, and maybe the best example is Vinny Viola and Mike Rapoli. Mm-hmm. I would also say the Reeves and Randy Hill and mm-hmm. the group that's essentially the Saratoga Box partnership that are it's just a nonstop party that goes from July 1st to June 30th every year, moving around from racetrack to racetrack. Certainly Randy loves to win, but he's going to have a good time, win or lose. There's another saying where we're giving everybody all the great maxims of racing history. Nothing gets in the way of a friendship faster than a good horse. who would you advise to look themselves in the mirror and understand that they're not necessarily suited to have people involved with them, that they're better off as a lone wolf?
Yeah, that's another good question, and it's pretty obvious, isn't it? It's the guy who has to be the center of attention all the time. You know, the best picture is the Derby with the Tom Durkin in the winner's circle at the Kentucky Derby. You know, kissing the roses and the trophy Tom, you say, Tom, well, you owned a Derby horse, didn't you? He says, yes. You know, you see the back foot there, that thing around the top of his foot, that's called a coronet band? He says, I own like 1/16th of that. And there's never been a happier guy to be in the Derby winner's circle.
Yep.
Happy to share the glory. If you can't share, the fun, you shouldn't be in a partnership. But it sorts people out. You and I both have done partnerships. Like I said, I used to do the star partnerships back in the 90s. And I would have up to a dozen or so people in a group of horses. And it quickly became apparent that some of them loved to share it as a social event. And some of them would get mad if we lost. And within, a very short period of time, they sorted themselves out. Some people were, we went into horses year after year, and some of them came and went. We were lucky. We had a real good string where we didn't lose money on a syndicate for I don't know how many years. We had a real good string, but that wasn't the point for a lot of people. It had to be win, win, win. And, it's not a game where you can win all the time. It just doesn't work that way.
No.
But it's a great game, as we say. It's a great game, greatest game outdoors.
So. Well, we need owners and horse players more than anything. those are the two, the two elements of the game that are absolutely the lifeblood, and we can't be stable, and we can't grow without players and owners.
No, absolutely.
Now, this is the Thoroughbred Investor's Bible, John Parada's latest. And, John, let's direct people, because they're, I can tell they're already asking. I've already got an email that they said they can't listen. How do they buy? How do they find it?
Well, you can buy it in the usual outlets, but I am directing people most of the time to my website, JR, that's John Robert, JR Parada, two R's and two T's, .com, which I have a Short Dog Publishing, and you can order it directly from there, or you can find it in most of the usual suspects. There's a link on the, at the races with Steve Bick. The Steve Bick site has a link, as it has with, you know, Racetrack for so many years, thank you. But I have had orders already from multiple, because people like people are contemplating starting their own. You know, let's have a partnership, or let's do this. But they've ordered multiples, so I tell them to go to my website and you can get it. You know, get free shipping and so forth.
Well, and of course, while they're there, they can also. You might as well, since you're there anyway. people who ordered Thoroughbred Investor's Bible also will be interested in Racetracker and The Altar Boy, If Wishes Were Horses, Half a Chance, and At the End of the Bar, and other stories. And of course, Out of Luck, for those that were Luck fans, and we all were, Out of Luck was the follow-up, what would have been season two, essentially. And if you missed it at America's Best Racing when John did it with a serial release, it's all in one place, Out of Luck, with the wonderful Jen Ferguson, who is the house artist of Short Dog Publishing.
She's the best.
Yeah.
She's the best.
Her stuff is tremendous. It's just great. Well, John, I've got a full docket, but we rifled through a half hour here. I wouldn't have minded having a little rip from today's headline thoughts from you as well, frankly. There's a good parting question. How do we assuage people's concerns about being involved in the game, if they have any?
Well, it is tough times, but I look back to Racetrack, or when the conclusion of that book, that's, like 5, 6, 7 years ago or something like that. And my sentiment at the end was that there are a lot of young, enthusiastic, intelligent, bright people who love the game, have come into the game, that love the game, and I think we'll give them credit, and we'll hope that they can overcome some of the mistakes that we allowed to be made over the years. And as somebody once told me, and I always stick to this, it's an ongoing game. It's bigger than anybody, any individual. It's a wonderful sport, and it's been around for forever, and it's an ongoing game. Let's look at it that way.
Well done. Well done. I appreciate it, John, and we will look forward to...
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Fresh year. No, this was great. JRParada.com is the easiest way to bring the Thoroughbred Investor's Bible to your doorstep, and all the rest of the Parada titles are available there as well. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
John Parada, folks, and the Thoroughbred Investors Bible. There it is. Sid Fernando is going to join us next, and then Jay Privman. So stay where you are. And, Case, let's get Sid in here, and let me let Jay know what's happening on our front. Because it is, let's see, we got about 20. All right, so we'll get to Jay after the top of the hour. All right. Yeah, let's do that. All right. All right. That's it. The other, you know, if for those that haven't read John's other books, here's your chance. And they're, you know, they're different. The Altar Boy. Very different treatment by John than the ones that are racetrack based. But Racetracker, If Wishes Were Horses, Half a Chance at the End of the Bar collection, short stories. And as I mentioned, Out of Luck is a lot of fun. If you loved luck and you know, it occurs to me as we wait for Sid. It is available now on HBO. Was it HBO Go? HBO? What is the stream service? You know, there was a period where it wasn't available, but it is now. And if you've never seen it, you know, for those that maybe have come to the game, you know, fairly recently, watch Luck. And speaking of film and television treatment, I've got the chance to thanks, Case, HBO Max, beautiful, not HBO. HBO Go was there. I think that was their original. Now it's Max. I got Doctor later, but when I come home, I'm looking forward. I think we're going to be able to watch Jockey later today. And, you know, it's going to go into release over the holiday. And looking forward to getting some of the players from Jockey on the show. Right now, though, Sid Fernando, Sire Watch, Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. Sid, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Sid, I'm good. You know, Sid, for those that have been following, Sid is on an absolute tear at the keyboard. You've been prolific with what essentially has been kind of a fresh new underground blog that we've talked about a little bit over the last few weeks. But I haven't seen an outpouring like this from you, maybe ever.
Yeah, thanks for bringing it up. Yeah, it's you know, I didn't realize this, but about a year ago, I'd actually set up a newsletter on Substack, but I'd never used it. And, you know, a few weeks ago after you had put that Chuck Simon kind of rant on a thread about something, which I thought was great. I just happened to talk to Chuck and told him that, hey, you know what? I'll write a guest blog on his, a guest post on his Going in Circles digest, which also happened to be on Substack, which I had no idea. And so when I did it, it came up on my Substack, and I realized, oh, shoot, I have a Substack here. And it just so happened that I got the flu for a couple of days. I was laid up in bed, and I just had my laptop, and I just started writing. And, you know, one thing led to another, and it just kind of continued.
Now, and you're, you know, you're hitting on topics of the day, and you know, the minute by minute, really. I mean,
exactly.
And through a prism of MF Doom, which is that's the part that makes this, you know, I mean, plenty of people, you know, offer bloggish diary entries that, you know, that are timely and pithy, but you're taking lyrics and applying them to a lot of the circumstances that, you know, that the industry's facing, and that's what makes this unique and fresh, and frankly, Sid, it feels like there's a certain audience that is finding it engaging, and others.
That's what's really been amazing to me.
Yeah.
And just to bring up MF Doom, you know, MF Doom was an artist, a hip hop artist, kind of a very mysterious entity. He'd originally had success kind of commercially as a teenager, okay, where you know, his moniker was Zev Love X. And then what happened, Steve, was that, and this group, KMD, included his brother, DJ Sub Rock, and his brother died, and it sent him into an anguished period of about 4 or 5 years, because he was so close to his brother. It was something I really, you know,
identified,
connected with.
Yeah.
And then when he reappeared, he came back as MF Doom, and MF Doom wore a metal mask on his face and kind of used himself as a supervillain. And so that whole conceit of wearing a mask and reinventing yourself and coming back. Well, that's what I kind of did with this newsletter, because my old blog used to be Sid Fernando Plus Observations. And now this new newsletter is the same thing. It's the same name, but it's kind of come back. Like you said, it's an underground blog. And it's allowed me to kind of put a mask on, in a way, or a mask on people I talk to, and discuss some of the issues of the day. And thanks for bringing up the MF Doom thing, because he's an incredible artist.
Well, and you know, I bring it up not just to call attention to your terrific writing in general, and you know, what is a fresh and typically unvarnished approach to any, you know, to anything that you work on. But what I think it is worth pointing out with this, it is that coming off the symposium and facing any number of industry-wide challenges, there's a message here about not necessarily reinvention as much as willingness to do something different and reimagined. And we're at a juncture in the game where I think everybody agrees we can't necessarily keep doing or trying to do the same thing that we've been doing, because it's put us in this, you know, seemingly untenable position as a business and as an industry, as a game. So looking at things in a new way or through a different kind of prism is going to be necessary to find a path forward. And you know, to your credit and, you know, to your career, which is spread out, you know, over three decades plus, you've done this on a regular basis. It should be, it should be championed because it's a blueprint for everybody, no matter how experienced, to try to bring a fresh perspective to the things that are vexing us as a game.
Wow, I'm blown away by that monologue of yours. That's incredible. It's true. I appreciate the compliments, but a lot of what you say is true about human nature too. We've got to keep changing and viewing things in a different way, and sometimes using another prism to view the same thing can show us, something we hadn't seen before. And I like the idea of using MF Doom in this for a number of reasons. Also, the fact is, he was a black intellectual. And, this is a historically white game, and to filter it through him and through some of his verses and his stuff is kind of exhilarating to see it, because it just shows us, anybody that's in anything, that these are all common issues, and sometimes when you view it through somebody else's lens, it helps to break down some of these issues for everybody to understand better, because people have been looking at it from the same vantage point for so long. Very much to your point about what you were just talking about. And, it's kind of nice for, what I've really enjoyed about it is I get, I'm not on social media under my name. I can view it through our company account. I never comment really on social media. As you know, I left it. And so I'm not on Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn or anything. So all of this stuff this underground newsletter, the only way it gets put out, aside from people subscribing to it, is through Barry the Sniper Spears. I've been friends with him. I like this guy, and he's a co-host with Chuck Simon on the Going in Circles podcast. And he and I, when I was on Twitter, we've always had hip hop exchanges and stuff. And so it's funny because I send it to him, and he puts it out on Twitter. And of course, he's got a really diverse background, and so what I'm finding is I'm getting a whole new level of readership that I've never had before. Also nice.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt.
Yeah.
The inclusion of the word prism as the focal or the visual of this, from what I said and your, in your view and your response, what's valuable about it is that when you look at anything through a prism, it goes in a different direction, and that that's what is necessary in plotting a way forward. And somebody wrote the other night, and I've started to answer it a couple of different times, a tweet, and saying, calling on me to get behind a commissioning body for the sport. And I don't know if it comes in my direction because the sense is that I'm not supportive of HISA. I'm not supportive of HISA for you know, for a very set of very clear set of reasons and concerns. I'm not objecting to it as a concept, as a you know, potentially beneficial concept, but as we discussed last week, and even followed up as recently as yesterday with Alan Foreman, there wasn't there isn't necessarily a need to completely essentially dismantle everything about the game and everything that is a current you know, foundation or you know, framework. There are things that need to be reevaluated and fine-tuned and adjusted. What has been under-discussed, Sid, in recent, just in the last couple of weeks, I mean, we're focused on this release of Heise's rules that they felt compelled to conjure up. In the rush to make the American game, you know, like this, you know, this nirvana of international racing, and this Brigadoon, because that's what it is. It's a Brigadoon. It's a fictional, you know, city that doesn't exist. I haven't seen much discussion about the arrests in France and the similar, you know, the other myriad of scandals that you know, the international racing landscape has seen in just in the last couple of months, not to mention stuff going back even earlier in the year. I mean, the feeding mishap that's never supposed to occur in involving, you know, Ballydoyle. I'm just sort of bewildered by the acceptance or the rush to believe that there's a panacea waiting here, when in fact, it, you know, to get back to what I mentioned the other day, what's required is all of us doing our utmost to, you know, doing our job well and being a good steward in our own arena, and if everybody just focuses on what, you know, what their assignment is, and stop, you know, looking over here in other arenas. That's why I brought up the cultivate your own garden as a potential idea to motivate. I think there's opportunity for all of us to, you know, to improve the landscape, but it's not going to happen if everybody's, you know, critiquing everybody else. Do your own job well, and you know, that starts with the horse, and go from there. We can carve out, you know, progress. I've been this coming out of the symposium, Sid, is stuff has really kind of weighed on me here for a week, and
they're all good points. Particularly, you know, your analogy of everything driven for quote unquote international harmony, which has been this phrase, international harmony, has cropped up over and over again, hasn't it? To try to make our game here, which is the dog, fit the tail of international harmony. I mean, the one basic element and the very unique element to American racing is that it's predominantly dirt racing. And it's a completely different game from the rest of the world.
Yep.
It's a game. It's a tough game. It's like the toughest proving ground in the world, and that's why everybody from the rest of the world wants the bloodstock from here, because if you're proven here, it's, you know, extremely desirable to take some of this bloodstock overseas. And when I'm talking about dirt racing, it's tough. It's tough on horses. It leads to more breakdowns. It leads to more bleeding. The character of the game is you come out, balls to the walls out of the gate, whether it's 6 furlongs or, you know, a mile and a quarter, and, you know, you empty the tank. I mean, it's almost easy to compare European racing as being namby-pamby to what's taking place here. And so, to try to fit this into a model that's, you know, works with this international harmony is a fallacy to begin with. In Europe, they run on more forgiving courses. They don't run as hard early. You have a much wider array of races, from sprints to marathon, you know, 2.5 mile races, various courses, undulating, soft, firm, all turf. The horses aren't stabled at tracks. They're not stabled in cities. And so, having said that, what these guys here wanted to do was to harmonize with the rest of the world, and what that really meant was to getting rid of race day LASIKs, right? And that's what this all was all about. And so the way for that to happen was to just obliterate the game here, just put it out that LASIKs was illegal, let that, you know, seep into the public view, completely break everything down here so that they could reconstruct it under a new set of protocols that appear to make this game how it is with the rest of the world. But, you know, the reality is, Steve, is that, you know, they may have done away with LASIKs, and you may have guys, you know, journalists just trumpeting how there's no bleeding and, you know, it's all about nothing. But if you really know the game, there's a lot of stuff that's come into play that's underneath the radar that people don't know about. You know, they may not be using race day LASIKs, but, you know, there's a lot of Chinese bleeder medications out there that are being used. Bettors know nothing about. This is what Jerry Brown was talking about. It was almost easier for bettors to know what was being used rather than not being used. And also, there's been changes in medication. You know how there's big news about, you know, how clenbuterol, which is a bronchodilator, which is also was used to treat bleeders as well, you know, how it's been pushed back to 21 days and stuff. But I've noticed reading medication stuff in various jurisdictions that albuterol, which is another bronchodilator like clenbuterol, is 72 hours. So you know, it's easy for everybody to announce that, oh, yeah, we've done away with clenbuterol for 21 days. But what they don't tell you is that they've given you albuterol at 72 hours. You know, so, you know, there's just so much sleight of hand taking place in all this. And this HISA thing has, you know, everything that you said about it is correct. Everything people like Chuck Simon have talked about. Chuck Simon was talking on a show the other day about how the cost of this is going to be prohibitive for the smaller tracks. You know, it's all been done to kind of pacify a raging public, which over the last decade we've seen become a much greater presence via social media. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is window dressing, and it's really not real. And unfortunately, a lot of it is built on really rickety foundations. And I'm speaking specifically of HISA because, and you know this because I've talked about this and your listeners do, you know, I have a big interest in legal issues and constitutional laws, and you know, in my opinion, there's been over 500 laws since I think 1990 that have been reversed in courts for being unconstitutional, and with all the stuff with all the suits from states on this thing, I think there's a real good chance that this thing will follow that route, too. So, I mean, right from the beginning, this thing was passed in the middle of the night, tacked on to a bill. It wasn't thoroughly vetted. And before you even get into the issues that you're talking about that are problematic with HISA, its very existence is problematic. Huh. And so that's one of the things that I find really, you know, everybody's just gung-ho. You know, everybody wants change. They want a sheriff with the white hat and all this. But, you know, how did this guy get appointed? And you know, are we supposed to subjugate the laws we're trying to establish just to get the thing up and running? You know, so there's so much behind this thing that's, questionable to begin with.
Hmm. It's got a parallel, actually, that is playing out on a national, on a separate topic, that you know, responding to a non-existent issue, essentially, and we'll see where it goes. I just I've enjoyed. It's been almost daily. And certainly as I was traveling, Sid, it was great that you know, I was on the road, I was able to read the pieces, explain to everybody where to find it too, because I think Substack will be new to any number of people.
Yeah, Substack is a platform like WordPress was and stuff like that. But if you go to Substack, you know, and type my name in, you'll be a Sid Fernando plus observations. You can find it there. Or if you're on Twitter and you scan through Barry Spear's timeline, you know, he's tweeted all the articles, and then you can go there and see him too. But you know, I had no idea you were even going to talk about this today, and I appreciate that. It's been kind of fun doing it because you're able to, on your own platform, you know, write about things that, sometimes he can't, or sometimes that have to be vetted on, more traditional platforms. But a lot of the issues that I'm really have written about recently are issues, like you said, that are topics of the day, and that needs, that I've just clarified, whether it's, the KHRC advisories on betamethasone, or, other stuff. It's all put there, and it's all put and written in kind of a way to view people as villains or heroes, because MF Doom kind of created himself. His role at MF Doom was based on the Dr. Doom villain, and his own vision was using a lot of pop culture and cartoons and stuff, and it applies so much, Steve, to racing, because there's so much cartoonish behavior in racing, you know what I mean?
No, that, good analogy.
That it kind of works that way, too.
Well, and I will send out the link momentarily, actually, when we go to break, so that people can find it very, very easily. And if you haven't seen Sid's most recent observations, it kind of, as we touched on, reinvented. Well, Sid, I appreciate it. I
likewise, I appreciate you bringing it up.
It was very good.
I never know what you're going to talk about, but you're surprising me. It makes this an appealing visit every week.
There you go. It might be as simple as throwing out a pedigree, or it might be much heavier. And so it doesn't. It just don't do it the way I approach the show 5 days a week. That way, I sit down and whatever, it's free association. Whatever pours out of me and out of the regulars and the guests. So, Sid Fernando, everybody, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale Work Thoroughbred Consultants. 510-490-1111. 510-490-1111, and it's getting kind of hectic when it comes to getting ready for the matings. You're running out of time a little bit. It's serious now. So get with Sid and Roger and the team, and get squared away for the coming breeding season. Sid, thank you. We'll wrap up the year next week. Let's take a break. When we come back, Jay Privman joins us, and we're going to celebrate Jay's election, essential election, selection to the Hall of Fame. It's a Hall of Famer. We can now say Hall of Famer Jay Privman joins us next. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only 3 states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. and because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify